Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, this week I tried to find a place in or near Bozeman where I could just hear relaxing natural sounds. I went to several walking trails and fishing access sites, trying to find the uninterrupted sounds of flowing water and birdsong, but I was failing. I used a decibel meter to see if it was just my imagination. Even in fishing access areas, the ambient levels, mostly of cars driving past, were up around 68 decibels, which my app tells me is similar to a quiet street, but I was really irritated by them. Well, on my fourth stop, I finally found a little water and bird song, and the decibel level was similar. So I realized it was the quality of the sound I was really seeking. Despite some runners and barking dogs, I managed to find a little satisfying soundscapes along Sourdough Trail. Today's episode of Desert Oracle Radio was produced by Ken Lane on February 9th, 2018. It's titled Desert Solitaire. I hope you like it.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the Mojave. And I heard that Joshua Tree National Park had nearly 3 million visitors in 2017, and it might be more next year. It's good to see so many of you exploring the desert, getting cholla stuck in your ankles, getting out there and falling in love with this landscape, this bioregion. But if you are dismayed at the traffic jams and the ruckus, we have many more millions of acres of beautiful wild desert landscapes like out of a dream. Places where you're the only car on the road, the only hiker on the trail. Try Mojave Trails National Monument. You get to drive historic Route 66 in the process. You can walk into an old volcano mouth. You can see bighorn sheep. You can watch the freight trains rumble by at Kelso and Afton Canyon. Lots of quiet areas in Death Valley. Or the Providence Mountains or the Castle Mountains. And when you have seen all of the Mojave, which nobody has ever done, nobody has ever seen all of the Mojave, well, then you've got the Great Basin to explore. You've got the Sonoran Desert on both sides of the border, slick rock and canyon country in Utah, Shiprock and Monument Valley on the Navajo lands. And you know there's a bar in the desert of Arizona that is only open 1 week a year. 1 week a year. I had somebody planning to do a story about that in the Desert Oracle. But none of us are very reliable. We try and we don't always succeed. And regardless of success or failure or more likely something in between, I guess, we are expected to get up the next day and do it again till the end of the road. I guess it's true for the Chuckwallas and the Elf Owls too. The raven and the hawk. I hope they enjoy it more than we do. Hello? It's a text message. Yeah, see, it's from Anna Merlin. Anna Merlin, the New York journalist. Boy, I hope she did not get into trouble up at Area 51 again. Dear Desert Oracle Radio, I'm so sorry to do this to you, but I'm heading out to the Mojave tomorrow with my partner so he can shoot something in California City. Photograph, not gun. Obviously, we will camp overnight and make a day of it on Friday. I'll scan my Desert Oracle back issues, but is there anything off the top of your head that you really love and think people should see out here? I want to go to Randsburg and see the not ghost town, but have not settled on anything else. Sorry to make you a desert tour guide. I'm sure people do it all the time. Well, I don't mind. This time of year, a lot of people come visiting, and usually when I hear from somebody coming to town, it's because they did not book a campsite or a motel, and so you're fine out there in the other end of the Mojave. California City. California City is a strange area. That's out in the Mojave High Desert north of Edwards Air Force Base, up by the spaceport in Mojave. You know, I tried to convince a friend of mine, I believe it was Oz Tyler, to join me in investing in land around that spaceport. This was maybe 15 years ago. And I thought if the spaceport really got going, not only with tourist and commercial spacecraft coming and going, but maybe also spacecraft from other worlds coming and going, well, then you could build this cantina at the spaceport, and oh, it would be wild, full of real aliens, and pirates and YouTubers, awkward weirdos from Silicon Valley, strange forms of life that blink in and out of our reality, never entirely there, yet still occupying the space, occupying that bar stool. I guess there would be laser sword fights and all that. Ron Howard in a corner shooting video. What a place that would be. Drink specials. So California City is or was, like so much of everything, a real estate scheme. In 1958, a real estate developer and a professor of sociology named Nat Mendelsohn. He was born in 1915 in Bohemia, just a few years before the state of Czechoslovakia was born in 1918. But he grew up in America, and he converted some army barracks into a successful new neighborhood in Riverside County. And then he got the idea for a massive new master-planned city on desert ranch land, a city that would rival Los Angeles in size. There were elements worthy of respect. The whole suburbia would be built around an 80-acre park, and there would be colleges and cultural centers, golf courses, of course, all drawing upon the seemingly endless clean well water from beneath the desert there. Nat Mendelsohn bought up some incredible desert ranch property, including the massive M&R Ranch above Boron, and the old Conklin Homestead, all this raw, wild desert, mostly raw, except for the alfalfa fields on the desert floor, fed by those easy wells, always full of easy water. The area sits on an underground lake likely replenished by underground rivers from the Sierra Nevada. Underground rivers, underground lakes. Good Lord, we don't know half the world around us. The Mojave River itself is mostly underground, only comes up at a couple of places, the Narrows north of Victorville, a place called Lane's Crossing, and over at Afton Canyon, and then the rest of the time it exists beyond our sight. There's a dry river we can see, and there's another river below it. The water comes from the San Bernardino Mountains, and the river ends at Zizek's at Soda Lake. Soda Lake used to be part of Lake Mojave. the massive inland sea that was still there 9,000 years ago, the time of a society called Lake Mojave Complex by anthropologists today. It was likely part of the Clovis culture, and sometime between 9,000 and 6,000 years ago, the big game was all gone. No more giant ground sloth, no more easy pickings. They were forced to adapt. Anyway, you are probably departed now if you get up earlier than I do. It's a weird area, the western Mojave, out by Edwards and Skunk Works. More wasteland and suburbia than whatever Joshua Tree is supposed to be, but there are treasures, both natural and unnatural. Here are some of the interesting places I would drive around to see when I lived on that side of the desert. None of them are close together, but they're all in the general on-the-way-there-or-back area. There's Red Rock Canyon State Park. It's beautiful canyons of multicolored rock around a scrubby desert wash. If you take geology in college out here, you will enjoy field trips to Red Rock. The 14 runs right through the middle of it. Not too far away, there's the Tortoise Preserve, the Desert Tortoise Natural Area. And there's no winter this year, so the tortoises might be out. Here's something cultural, I guess. The Kill Bill Church. I've never seen Kill Bill, but I have been to the church where Uma Thurman was strangled by Quentin Tarantino, according to Twitter this week, I guess. Sure are a lot of problems out there. I guess I'm glad I never watched Kill Bill. But the church is there. You'll find this place at 19809 East Avenue G in Lancaster. It's a community center. And if you enjoyed being traumatized by the recent Twin Peaks series, the Desert Motel, where Agent Cooper and Diane stop for the night before they are sent to hell, our world, after performing a depressing sex magic ritual, well, that's in the very little town of Pear Blossom. You'll find it at 13250 Pear Blossom Highway. And if you keep driving east this way, about 30 miles east of Pear Blossom, you'll come across the landscape and David Hockney's Pear Blossom Highway, with Joshua trees and garbage on the roadside. And there's a grim and dying suburb called Lake Los Angeles north of here. There is no lake. Do not camp around here, as you will be murdered and cut into little pieces by roving lunatics. You know, there was a lake there long ago, and the Bonanza TV show was often filmed at this Lake Los Angeles. Put in a pine tree or two and call it Tahoe, why not? There are three places off base where you can visit Edwards Air Force Base displays, such as the Blackbird spy planes and the U-2. Tours are booked up a year in advance for the base itself and the Aerospace Museum on base, but there are three places at the gates that are worth visiting. The Blackbird Air Park is at 2503 East Avenue P in Palmdale. And there's a mini museum and a gift shop. I think it's open Fridays through Sundays. Let's see here. 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Fridays through Sundays. The West Gate on Rosamond Boulevard has the F-Series fighters, a whole circle of them. And the North Gate has a B-52 and some other hardware. And it's just great driving around up here. Stop in the town of Mojave and get lunch and a beer. Now, there's also Rocket Site Road, a haunted and cursed place you should see. South of the 58, take the road as far as you can, and you'll see all these insane, giant, rusting hulks of rocket engines bolted to the mountain. Many bad things have happened here. Then you might as well turn around, go to downtown Boron, an interesting pair of museums that I believe are also open on the weekends. At the 20 Mule Team Museum, look for the display on the Walking Man. Ask to see the boots of the Walking Man. We've talked about him on the program before. I could tell you about another dozen places, but you're only there for a day or two, so I'll just tell you good luck. Hey, we've got one more campfire stories for the season down at the Ace Hotel, March 1st. That's Thursday, 7 p.m. That's also the night of a Bureau of Land Management community meeting in Joshua Tree, 7 p.m. March 1st. It's important. It regards the fate of our California desert wilderness.
Well, hello to you all.
Hey.
You all look like very good campers.
Really?
Yeah. And you're not starting fights. You're not abusing the wildlife. So, happy to have you. I'm Ken Lane from Desert Oracle. We're going to do campfire stories. Has anyone ever gone to summer camp and heard campfire stories?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. How about at a national park or some such thing with a park ranger?
That too. Yeah.
Well, those stories at national parks, the rule is they're supposed to be true and they're supposed to be helpful or educational in some way. I'm under no such obligation. But the stories I tell you will still be true. There may be parts that sound fantastic and insane, but at least someone somewhere claimed such things happened. First, I want to talk a little bit about some of the wonderful desert wildlife we have in the desert. How many people here live in the desert? Oh, we have desert people. Desert people. Desert people get nervous when they hear water coming out of a lawn sprinkler by the electrical outlets. Desert people are smart that way. Not smart enough to do anything about it, but smart enough to look over with concern. You know, I've been doing these campfire stories here for about 7 or 8 months, and I'm starting to think there's a timer on the sprinklers. Because every time at 7 o'clock when we start the campfire stories, there are a few nervous moments when the sprinklers turn on. Now, when Europeans first came to North America and came out to the American desert, they described pretty much everything beyond the plains as what they called the Great American Desert. This was not a world, an environment that people from, say, England or Virginia were familiar or comfortable with. Everything seemed to be wrong. First of all, there's very little water, so good luck trying to farm. Second, every animal and every plant seems to sting or poke you or bite you or hiss at you or howl at you. So it took a while for observational science to catch up with the shock of so many weird, terrible animals and plants as we have across the deserts. We tonight are in the Colorado Desert. We call it Colorado Desert because it's part of the Sonoran Desert, but it is the part of the Sonoran Desert that is west of the Colorado River, between the mountains, the coastal ranges in Southern California, transverse ranges as you go up, and the Colorado River. It is a hot desert. It's a desert that gets monsoons every year. They come up through the Gulf of California, the old Sea of Cortez, in the summertime. Humidity from the tropics, big thunderclouds, lightning, flash floods, loss of life and property. It's incredible. We didn't get much of that lately. Here in the Colorado Desert and the desert just to the north, which is called the Mojave Desert, Joshua Tree, Yucca Valley, etc., We have a lot of curious reptiles and animals. One of my favorites is called the Western Coach Whip. It's also known as the Red Racer. This is an in-between snake in the desert, meaning it's somewhere in between. It can bite you and kill you, or you can ignore it. The Coach Whip, Red Racer, whatever you want to call it, is not venomous like a pit viper. It doesn't have those big teeth in the front that are hollow. Instead, it has kind of a grungy kind of something or other in its mouth, and it likes to bite on and chew. Chew and chew and chew. So between the chewing and the mildly venomous saliva, somewhat like the Gila monster, which also has a mildly venomous saliva, the Coach Whip can do a lot of damage, even though it's not a rattlesnake. Coach Whip is a weird-looking snake. If you see one zipping by, and you usually see them zip by, that's why they're called Red Racers, the tail becomes like the end of a whip as you go from the red to the black to the end of the whip. This is why the pioneers out in the desert saw this thing, and they said, well, it looks like a bullwhip. It looks like you can pull it right by the head and use it as a bullwhip on your horses or your jackass mule or whatever you had, if you were lucky enough to have some kind of pack animal out in the desert. So the legend spread from the early pioneers in the desert that the Red Racer had a special skill. The Red Racer, the Western Coach Whip, if you grabbed at it, would whip its tail around your neck and choke you to death. A lot of scientists believed this in the 1800s, mid-1800s. Mostly scientists who had never been to the desert. If you've ever seen old illustrations, line drawings, kind of encyclopedia-type illustrations of desert animals from the Victorian era, and I frequently use them in Desert Oracle. That's the magazine we publish in Joshua Tree. It's more of a book than a magazine, especially in how frequently it comes out. I like to use those illustrations, and I mostly like to use them because they look off. They look like somebody described a desert animal, perhaps in a letter, without drawing it, and then maybe sent it back to England, where someone just kind of went wild with their imagination. The Red Racer is a fierce hunter. It can climb trees, it can climb fences, it can climb through your window. It is not shy or indifferent like most, say, rattlesnakes, gopher snakes. The Red Racer is kind of mean if you get to know it. In fact, the Red Racer is the only snake I've ever seen in 3+ decades of roaming the deserts that will come right at you. They'll hunt birds out of trees. They'll catch lizards as lizards jump from one rock to another. They're fantastic animals, but they will not wrap their tail around your neck and strangle you. That is a falsehood. So when you see a Red Racer, don't touch it. Just because it's not really poisonous doesn't mean it cannot hurt you. There are lots of drunken fools who have gone camping over the years who have tussled with them, and they have big, chewy wounds on their hands and other extremities. You don't generally see a Sasquatch or our desert Sasquatch, the Yucca Man, in a strip mall. You usually don't see them on the bus. You usually don't see them at Starbucks. But you do see such things if you're in the right frame of mind and you're lucky and it's the right time in the wilderness. The wilderness is where our mind does something a little different. Or maybe there are really monsters. We're not sure. Deserts as preserves are places that we can kind of keep in the back of our mind. We can keep them in the back of our mind even when we're not there. We can use them for different things. We can, as so many people do now, go stay a weekend in Airbnb in 29 Palms, go for a hike in Death Valley, get out away from the noise, off often even away from cell phone coverage, which is very nice if you can get it, and experience a different reality. And even when you're not there, the writer Edward Abbey said, wilderness should be there as an escape valve, as a place where if all else fails, you have a place to run and hide. John the Baptist hid in the desert wilderness, dressed in animal skin, baptizing people by the river. He probably could not have gotten away with that in town. It's our escape valve, especially around a place with 24 million people, which is what Southern California has. The deserts and mountains that ring this most populous part of the most populous state in the country, we need just in case. And then if your brain breaks, and you can no longer live in the city or the suburb, then you might want to move there. So I've heard. When you move out to the desert, you quickly find that your neighbors don't really want to talk to you either. So it's kind of nice. There's a proverb, I can never remember it exactly right. It's been a while since Sunday school, but it was something like, if your neighbor does not prevent you from always visiting, eventually your neighbor will grow to hate you and kill you. That's not exact King James Version, but it's something like that. And it's really one of the wonders of going out and staying in a cabin where you can walk outside on a desert night. A desert night like this, with stars in the sky, not too much light pollution, and life doesn't seem so small anymore.
You know, it was 50 years ago that Edward Abbey's classic, The Bible of Desert Conservation, a book of beauty and importance, full of bracing prose and adventure and comic misadventure. It was 50 years ago when that was first published, Desert Solitaire. It is a very important book, but besides that, it is a great book to read. I wrote something about it for the Los Angeles Times. It's in the Sunday book section. I believe it's already online. And I needed to look at Ed Abbey's great book again to refresh some details in my memory, to find a quote or two to include in the piece. And my God, that book is impossible to put down. I first read it in January 1983, 35 years ago now, and it's not an exaggeration to say it changed my life and gave me mission and purpose, not to mention a very bad example to follow in the author, Edward Abbey. Bad in some ways, mostly good. Edward Abbey never got rich, he never got that famous. He got married too often, and most of his life was frittered away, making late child support payments and waiting for this or that government ranger job, government fire lookout job, a way to pay for food and wine and books without sitting in a windowless office under fluorescent lights. You know, he did that too. He sat in offices writing technical manuals for washer dryers. He sat in offices approving people's requests for financial aid and food stamps. But he never did it for long. He could not take it. There's a lot more coming this year from Desert Oracle in celebration of a half century of Desert Solitaire. Go read it if you have not read it. And if it's been a while, read it again. It'll put a spring in your step, some fire in your belly. We mention March 1 as the last date of our last Campfire Stories of the season, a pleasant night under the stars and around a campfire, Thursday night, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's free, it's open to all. The Ace Hotel and Swim Club in Palm Springs. Thanks for listening to Desert Oracle on KCDZ, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio. Last week, I read some of my favorite selections to you. Well, this week, I found audio from some of my favorite authors reading their own works. Our first author is Edward Abbey himself, reading from his audiobook, Freedom and Wilderness.
Thank you.
Next is another of my favorite authors, Doug Peacock, reading from his recent book, Was It Worth It? I found this on YouTube, and it was produced by Elk River Books in Livingston before a live audience.
This is called Winter Comes. It's the opening to this new book. I log my life by Winter Comes, in the fashion of Plains tribes who painted significant events on the inner sides of a bison hide. This might be a battle, a treaty, an encounter with a dangerous creature, finding a spirit animal, or possibly a winter so cold the cottonwood trees split apart. Though the indigenous peoples tended to mark each year, not every year of my life was worthy of a winter count. Some counts could come bundled in decades with only the rivulets of spring runoff and the emergence of bears to mark the in-between times. So it was with me. I started a new count in 1968. There was my life before the war that prepared me for a life in the wilderness, a good life, full of swamps, rivers, woods, deserts, and mountains. From 1965 to 1968, I worked as a special forces medic who attended too much collateral damage, that cowardly phrase they apply to the pile of small, dismembered bodies after a botched air attack. After March 1968, I applied the anger I had built doing that to the demands of wild things, dimly realizing that the fate of the earth and her inhabitants depended on uncompromising protection of the wilderness homeland and wild creatures. My war experiences, good and bad, prepared me for the fight. It was a gift. I learned to love grizzly bears. I also fell in love with the Lower Sonoran Desert, a romance started in the early 60s but broken by the separation of the war. Space and endless clean vistas, unbroken by the forest I so cherished up north. By late 1968, I had two opposing mistresses, grizzly bears in the northern Rockies and the desert southwest. When the bears hibernated, I hightailed it south. It's winter now, and I sit in a sun-filled desert wash. A few ground flowers are blooming, and the stalks of brittlebush show a rare yellow blossom. I sit several days' walk from where Ed Abbey is buried. This Lower Sonoran Desert country is still considered a wilderness, and I miss my buddies with whom I shared many of these adventures. Ed Abbey, Peter Matheson, Doug Tompkins, and Jim Harrison. I've always dreaded the loss of wild country so much that I cared not to live without it. Now another threat, the beast of our time, the warming planet, has etched into the sky, and every creature on Earth bigger than a field foal is at risk of decimation or extinction. And there it is, back to Abbey's ancient quandary. What to do? Duty textures in with the joy of living fully and loving the earth. Except for a pledge to fight to the literal end, I never quite solved this problem. Everybody's mortality is in the lens now, and it's not necessarily a telephoto shock. About Yellowstone, you know. A long time ago, it was like in the 1970s when I was pretty much in there by myself. I was crazy. I just come back from Vietnam, and I'm just going to read you a couple opening paragraphs here to tell you how crazy those times were. Okay, and chapter one is called The Hayduk Ancestry. And you know, I've got my Hayduk lives. Anyway, here I go. Oh, wait a minute, that's the first time. The Hayduk Ancestry. And this is a quote from Ed Abbey. If wilderness is outlawed, only outlaws can save the wilderness. That's old Ed. Even today, the flash of a Hayduk Lives bumper sticker is not an uncommon sight on the byways and in the parking lots of America. For me, this signals a public acknowledgement that the writings and teachings of Ed Abbey still matter. We care about the wild ones, and believed that maybe the wilderness is the only thing left worth saving. How did the fictional character of George Washington, Hayduke, come into imagining? Only Edward Abbey could know precisely how those particular threads came together. But the part of George that Ed borrowed from the real-life Peacock had distinct origins that were rooted in wilderness, in both the trauma and the value of recovering from war. The most indispensable wilderness experience in my life arrived quite accidentally in Yellowstone National Park during the decade after I returned from Vietnam. Accidental because I stumbled into the park's lodgepole pine forest at the peak of a hallucinatory malaria paroxysm. I'd had a lot in Vietnam, so I knew what was going on. It started in high eastern Wind River range, so I knew it was coming. And I dreamed of grizzlies that turned out to be real bears. And I had a fever of 105.6 when I went out of my mind. I didn't know if the bears were real or not, but the tracks were all around where I decided to pitch my tent. I was kind of stupid back then. Okay. That experience can't be replicated today because of human crowding. It occurred long enough ago that the National Park Service didn't especially think a wacko hiding on their backcountry was worth looking for. That was a combat vet Ed Abbey met in 1968 and upon whom he later based the fictional character of George Washington Haydu. With its wildlife, wilderness, and thermal areas of refuge from deep snows, I considered Yellowstone's backcountry a paradise. And I wanted to indulge in pockets of it without interference from the outside world. This was still possible in the Yellowstone long before talks of bringing in fast food and the internet to National Park Service campgrounds. You remember that? A couple years ago. Yeah. It also meant I had to hide out, like an escaped POW might have attempted in Vietnam. At that time, there was no sane boundary for me between living in the edge of the Yellowstone National Park and the fantasy of looting capture by the Viet Cong hunting for me in the jungles of Vietnam. That was really a crazy sumbitch. I had one close encounter in Southeast Asia and had yet to shake the nightmare loose. I wanted to chisel the episode out of my life like a malignant lesion. But back then I couldn't. I was terrified of somebody finding me camped in the woods of America. I traveled around with this irrational fear buried in my backpack while tramping across the meadows and through the lodgepole pine forest. The shrinks would later try to provide chunky terminology for this pathology a decade and a half later, you know, PSPT and such, In the meantime, I prowled around Yellowstone like a madman. That's okay. Leaving no tracks in the rapidly melting snow, I built a criterion for half a dozen paranoid categories, all of which I embraced as necessary for a life in the wild. It pushed me to the edge. My contact with park rangers was infrequent and cordial. Sometimes I came out of the woods to fly fish Yellowstone River. My favorite band was Midway Geyser Basin, you know, where hot springs sprang up and young grizzlies sometimes swam. In October 1968, there were very few park visitors, and one ranger used to leave his patrol vehicle on the top of the golden grass-covered bluff and walk down to the river to ask how the trout fishing was. It happened to be great, with big 2 to 3 pound brown trout rising to small flies. His pleasant small talk constituted my entire social life. I really enjoyed that guy. But as soon as I hit the wilderness, I instinctually started sneaking around. I followed deep bison trails cut through the spring snow cornices in the afternoons, where my tracks would melt away in hours. And for instance, my clothing, gear, and tents, mostly from Army Surplus, were all earth covers, and I carried a white sheet in case a plane spotted me snowshoeing in the middle of a snowy meadow. And I had to cover up, so you hear it. You throw your pack down, jump on top of it, put the white sheet over everything you work. Any comments or questions?
I want to include another of my favorite authors, Annie Dillard. In my search for a recording of her reading from her own works, I found out that there are very few recordings like that. But I found a piece produced by Foothills Unitarian Church, and this is a reading of Annie's essay, Living Like Weasels.
A weasel is wild. Who knows what he thinks? Obedient to instinct, he bites his prey at the neck, and he does not let go. One naturalist refused to kill a weasel who was socketed into his hand as deeply as a rattlesnake. The man could in no way pry the tiny weasel off, and he had to walk half a mile to water, the weasel dangling from his palm, and soak him off like a stubborn label. And once, says Ernest Thompson Seton, once a man shot an eagle out of the sky, and he examined the eagle and found the dry skull of a weasel fixed by the jaws to his throat. The supposition is that the eagle had pounced on the weasel, and the weasel swiveled and bit as instinct taught him, tooth to neck, and nearly won. I would like to have seen that eagle from the air a few weeks or months before he was shot. Was the whole weasel still attached to his feathered throat, a fur pendant? Or did the eagle eat what he could reach, gutting the living weasel with his talons before his breast, bending his beak, cleaning the beautiful airborne bones? We can live any way we want. People take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, even of silence, by choice. The thing is to stalk your calling in a certain skilled and supple way, to locate the most tender and live spot and plug into that pulse. This is yielding, not fighting. A weasel doesn't attack anything. A weasel lives as he's meant to, yielding at every moment to the perfect freedom of single necessity. I think it would be well and proper and obedient and pure to grasp your one necessity and not let it go, to dangle from it limp wherever it takes you. Then even death, where you're going, no matter how you live, cannot you part. Seize it and let it seize you up aloft even till your eyes burn out and drop. Let your musky flesh fall off in shreds and let your very bones unhinge and scatter loosened over fields and woods lightly, thoughtless, from any height at all, from as high as eagles.
My thanks to Ken Lane for his work on Desert Oracle Radio, and thanks to Elk River Books, to Doug Peacock, Foothills Unitarian Church, and to Rick Lewis, who all made their productions available on YouTube. Our sounds today have come from Sourdough Creek, the birds in my front yard, and from Beloved Mountain. Thank you, Gallatin Valley, and everyone for listening. You can call and leave me a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 1-406-404-6246. You can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. Till next week, stay well and sweet dreams. P.S. Here's a bird note, and the sound of this bird always makes me laugh. I hope you like it too. Thank you, bird note.
This is Bird Note. With its rubbery-sounding rattles and clownish red eyebrows, the ptarmigan is quite the standout northern bird. And it's particularly well-adapted to wintertime in the snowy realms it calls home. Like Cinderella at midnight, this bird is utterly transformed by winter. During its autumn molt, the ptarmigan sheds its mottled brown plumage for a cloak of snowy white. And skip the glass slippers. As the winter approaches, the ptarmigan's feet grow feathers. Even the bird's claws grow longer. And that added surface area means the ptarmigan is ready to travel over the snow. It practically has its own set of snowshoes. If you or I tried to travel across ptarmigan turf in winter, we'd likely sink into the snow up to our shins, our thighs, or even our hips. But not this bird. The ptarmigan's genus name, Lagopus, is a combination of the Greek words meaning foot and hare. Like a rabbit, Lagopus, hare-foot. The name's a nod to another big-footed northerner, the snowshoe hare. For more on the ptarmigan and other birds we feature, check out our website, birdnote.org. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. BirdNote gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at BirdNote Radio.
Discover the latest in dinosaur science with our top recommendation today. Every week, the I Know Dino podcast shares amazing new scientific discoveries about dinosaurs. A new dinosaur is named almost every week, and I Know Dino is the only podcast that covers every new dinosaur discovery. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.